Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
The Lifestyle Show, presented by Selena McKenzie.
Now, we've all heard of Anne Boleyn, but do you know who Jane Boleyn is? Well, here to tell us about her latest book, Boleyn Traitor, a thrilling story of ambition, power and the dark side of the Tudor court. Welcome, top historian Philippa Gregory.
Hello, lovely to be with you.
Lovely to have you on the show, Philippa. So over to you. Who was she then?
Well, Jane Boleyn is known to most people, but maybe not by name. She's the wife of Anne Boleyn's brother. So he's George Boleyn, and she married him when they were both quite young, 20, and they were top courtiers when Anne was queen. But when the Boleyns fell from favour and Anne was tried for incest, adultery and witchcraft, George was tried with her for incestuous adultery. So Jane was widowed on his death, and she also lost her place at court, obviously. She lost the position which had come to her as being sister-in-law to the queen. But what is amazing is that she's right back at the top of the tree again when Jane Seymour is the new queen. Henry marries Jane Seymour straight away and appoints Jane as her chief lady in waiting. And Jane stays as the chief lady in waiting to all the subsequent queens until Catherine Howard, when she herself gets involved in Catherine Howard's disgrace and is herself executed. So the big question for me and for everybody, which is nobody has ever answered, is how does Jane go from absolute disgrace to top place at the court of all the subsequent queens? And in this novel, I think I've answered that question.
Do you think it has anything to do with Thomas Cromwell?
I do.
Me too. I mean, well, I haven't read your book, but I'm a huge fan of the Tudor court.
Well, Thomas Cromwell is a friend of Jane's father, and it is to Thomas Cromwell that Jane dedicates and gives his first translation of Niccolò Machiavelli's The Prince, which is the absolute textbook of how to be a tyrant. And so I am sure that Thomas Cromwell spotted in Jane someone who had no attachments in the court and no hope of surviving at the court unless he took her under his wing. I think he recruited her to be one of his very, very widespread spy network, and that he put her in this position of extraordinary power and influence.
Mm. People might know her as Jane Parker. She was originally known, wasn't she? If you often watch the Tudor programmes, she's known as Jane Parker because that's how she was born. She only became, obviously, Jane Boleyn when she married George.
Yes, yeah, she's the daughter of Lord Morley, who is whose family name is Parker. So she's Jane Parker when she first comes to court. Then she's Jane Boleyn when she's married to him. And when he's gets a title, she's then Lady Rochford. So she's one of these people which is, as all women, a little bit more difficult to trace through history because you have to keep an eye open for, in her case, three names.
Yeah, indeed. I thought that she was probably part of the reason that Anne Boleyn was executed, and you know, because of partly because of her supposedly incestuous relationship with her brother, but clearly it wouldn't have been, because that made her own downfall as well.
Yes, I mean, what's so interesting is that Jane's reputation has literally risen and fall with the fashion of historians in how they look at women. So the Victorian historians, which were very judgmental of women and who had a very strict code of behaviour, believed that Jane was a bad woman because she was a bad wife in that she failed to save her husband from execution by Henry VIII. Like, it's almost impossible to save your husband from execution by Henry VIII, but Jane failed to do it. And so the Victorian historians assumed from that she may have been even complicit in his trial and execution. There's no evidence for that in the chronicles of the time. No one at the time thought that was the case. And then later historians, interestingly enough, who go more into psychology, suggest that Jane was peculiarly in her sexual tastes, in that they suggest that she liked to watch her husband and sister-in-law having adulterous sex, and that she then liked to watch Catherine Howard having adulterous sex with her husband, which, if you think about it with any sort of sanity, is absolutely ridiculous. If you had a niche perversion of voyeurism, if you were at the Tudor court at the position Jane was in, you could satisfy that far more safely than deciding that the only thing you really liked was to watch Queens of England. I mean, it's absurd. But it's very much how historians treat women, that they find a sort of a stereotype picture of them, and then they write the history to agree with that. But when I came to look at Jane, I wanted to start with a clean slate. So I went right the way back to her childhood, which showed me this very scholarly and cultured father who was on the fringes of the Tudor court, but was careful never to be too close. And then she has this extraordinary ambition, and she rises with the Boleyns, and then extraordinary, she doesn't fall with them. And none of that leads you to any sort of nonsense about, is she a good woman or is she not a good woman? You see that she's in the right place at the right time to be successful, until the times change and she is in the right place to be in terrible danger. And that's all about the politics of the Tudor court, all about the reality of the Tudor court, and nothing about how people think about women and how they project onto women their own ideas of what women are like.
And was it her that was ambitious, or was it her father? Because I think about Anne Boleyn and how much her father pushed her, well, her sister to start with, to get in with Henry VIII. Was it Jane Parker, or was it her father pushing her?
Her father's ambitious enough that he places her at court as a child of 12, as maid of honour to Catherine of Aragon. But I think if you look at his own behaviour, he's through and through, he's a scholar. He stays most of his time at his country house, which is a big, beautiful country house. And he comes up to London only when he's obliged to sit on the very many trials which Henry VIII puts on his friends. He clearly supports her, but he also supports Lady Mary, the king's daughter, the Roman Catholic daughter. And I think he's probably a supporter of Catherine of Aragon, though he's never very strong in any of these roles. I think any ambition in Jane, we have to see as her own, because her father was not in a position to get her promoted, nor was he apparently much interested in the politics of the court.
And was there any proof, Philippa, that she was part of the downfall of Anne Boleyn?
No, what we have in terms of actual records, and not the speculation of subsequent historians, there's nothing on record. We've got one glimpse of her in a letter when she promises her husband, George, that she will speak to the king, that she will try to speak to the king. But we have no record of her speaking to the king, and we have no record of her giving evidence against him. In my book, I suggest that she is already spying for Thomas Cromwell by this time. So anything she said to Cromwell, he would have used, but he'd have used however he wanted it. So it could literally have been a completely innocent conversation, which Cromwell, you know, with his extraordinary political ability, decides to use one way or another. But of the women who did, you know, we do know the three women who gave evidence against Anne, and Jane's name is not on the list.
From what I've read, I'm sure you'll put me right, but she does seem like quite a villainous person. I mean, she did become close confidant to Catherine Howard when she was lady-in-waiting, and she even tried to get her and, was it Thomas Culpepper, together, but then turned on them, didn't she?
Yeah, I mean, that's very much this subsequent telling of her story of her as a bad woman, which I don't think there's any solid evidence for. She certainly was present at the meetings between Thomas Culpepper and Catherine Howard. But if you read Catherine Howard, the Queen's own letter to Thomas Culpepper, it's a love letter of a very young woman. She's only 17. She's madly in love with this young man. And I believe that she said to Jane, I'm going to meet him. You know, like it or not, I'm going to meet him. And Jane probably thought the safest way was to be present at the meetings and to try and keep the lid on it, keep it quiet, keep it in a safe place, and hope that the king never discovered it, knowing that the king was by now so old and so physically sick that the chances of him dying before he caught Catherine were quite high, in which case Jane is then very, very, very well placed to be Catherine, who would now be a dowager queen and possibly even regent queen, and Jane's her best friend, and she has the biggest blackmail secret in the world. So that sense, she encourages her. I don't think she encourages her. I think she helps them out. But when they're all held up to trial, they all turn on each other. It's a very, very, and that's where we have a lot of information, which is that Culpepper and Catherine Howard both blame Jane for getting them together. But actually, if you look at the letter from Catherine to Culpepper and his mad stupidity in keeping the letter, these are the actions of two not very good conspirators, but two people very much in love.
Yeah. Did you, from all your research, do you like her? Do you think she's a decent enough person?
I try not to be judgmental in my research. I think I do a better job if I come to it fairly clean without a judgment, and if I end without much judgment, I've done a good job as a historian. As a novelist, I like my Jane. I mean, I don't know how close my Jane is to the historical Jane as she was lived, but I'm sure it's closer than some of these historians who have tried to make her out to be the villain of the piece, because it suits their telling of the story and it suits their view of women. My view of women is much more generous and much more realistic than that. And I think that Jane, like most women in history, was trying to get by, trying to survive in incredibly dangerous circumstances, and trying to, you know, make a good living and have a good life. And, you know, none of that, I think, is at all blameworthy.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you've got lots of books, the Plantagenet and Tudor novels, the Fair Mouse series. Have you written just history books, non-fiction factual history books as well?
Yes, my last book, called Normal Women, 900 Years of Making History, was in a very real sense the work of my life. It took me 10 years to write.
Wow.
I've been working on it since then in other editions and other publications, one for young scholars, one for literally to be primary school readers, to go into schools to tell young people about the history of women in England. And I have a TV documentary in mind and possibly a radio program in mind. I'd done a podcast on it. So it really is very, very central to my life. And that's nonfiction, completely nonfiction, but it's the story not of the big stars, the big queens, the names, you know. It's the story of women from 1066 to the present day, and how we as women have constantly struggled for fair pay, have constantly struggled for shares of ownership of land, and factories and businesses, how we've stepped forward in times of crisis. So during the plague, women run England because so many men are killed. And how during wartime, for instance, when men are taken away to war, women step forward and run the country in their absence. And how after the emergencies and after the wars, women are forced or asked to step back into their homes, into domestic life. And that's when you get all the propaganda which says children are best raised by women at home and that the whole of the fabric of the country will collapse unless women are at home. And you see, when you look at it over, you know, nearly 1,000 years, you really see this ebb and flow of how women are called into positions of great power and authority and responsibility and how they are dismissed again and how what's really compelling about the story is how women always step up into opportunity and into responsibility and how so far they've always stepped back after the emergency. But I think what we're seeing now is probably a genuine change that women are becoming essential to the running of the country and we won't get asked to step back further than we are already. But, you know, I have to remind everyone we still don't have equal pay. The last time we had equal pay in England was 1349.
That is mad, isn't it?
Isn't it mad?
Isn't it mad?
Yeah, and you only get that perspective if you do really long history. And the reason we got it in 1349 was because there were so few labourers available to do any of the work that they had to pay women the same as the men, because otherwise women simply wouldn't have gone to work. And that's just after the plague year. So they have to have, they have to pay equal pay. And that's the last time within 10 years. Within 10 years, the government is passing laws to say that women shall not be paid equally and that women must work at home.
Well, let's hope that within the next 10 years that we can say something different. Surely it won't be the same.
It won't be the same. I think the battle now is still to get equal pay. We don't have it yet. But also, I think we've really got to look at ownership and directorships and senior management. They are still incredibly skewed against women. So ownership of land. I mean, I think farming tenancies, it's something like 12% of them are owned by women. You know, whereas what we know is that farming families have boys as well as girls. You know, why shouldn't girls inherit? Why shouldn't girls get the tenancy?
Yeah, good point, well made. Well, the book is called Boleyn Traitor, a thrilling story of ambition, power and the dark side of the Tudor court. It's by Philippa Gregory, who we're chatting to now. And as always, we're selling it on our website, tre.radio. Philippa, if people want to find out more about you and your books, do you have a website as well?
I have all of the stuff. Everybody has all the stuff now. I have a website and I have a Facebook page and I think I'm on Instagram and I'm probably now and then on TikTok. But if you just have a little Google with my name, Philippa Gregory, you will find me. I am out there.
You certainly are. Thank you so much for your time, Philippa.
Thank you.
Bye-bye for now. Bye.
Marriott Bonvoy is the official hotel partner of US Soccer. Join Marriott Bonvoy today to get closer to the game with exclusive perks, unforgettable experiences, and benefits that go beyond the pitch. Spring Hill Suites, part of Marriott Bonvoy, offers complimentary hot breakfast and spacious all-suite accommodations, perfect for the whole team, with room for up to 6 guests. Make your next getaway a win. Learn more at springhillsuites.marriott.com.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.